Hello, I'm Neil Schwartzman. This is number 0420, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0420. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we remember actor Richard Anderson, who recently died at the age of 91. He was best known for playing Oscar Goldman on The $6 Million Man.
It had a nice ring to it when my representative called and says, "How would you like to be in The $6 Million Man?" I said, that has a nice sound to it. I somehow got a voice inside that said, I think we're onto something.
Author Raymond Benson, who is one of the official writers of the James Bond books, he has his own thriller out entitled The Secrets on Chicory Lane, which has a female protagonist.
You know, I've been writing female protagonists a lot lately. In fact, this is my 11th book with a female protagonist. I joke that I say that I used up all my testosterone on James Bond, and now I write women. But anyway, she is a romance writer, a very successful romance writer living in Chicago, and she receives a letter from an attorney in Texas who tells her that her best friend, childhood friend, Eddie, is about to be executed. He's on death row, and his last request was to see her.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabbie, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. What happens when a cab driver hears the call of nature?
A taxi driver has a real problem. What's he going to do? There's no place to park. There's no place to stop. There's no such thing as public bathrooms or anything like that. What they do, and I'll try to tell the story kind of delicately, is the average New York City cab driver will start off his shift with a cup of coffee, let's say. Well, once he finishes the cup of coffee, he keeps the cup, if you catch my drift.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0420 was Neil Schwartzman. He's the spam fighter at cause.org. That's spelled cause.org. The spam fighter is out there fighting against spam for you. Not the tasty luncheon meat, which is the luncheon meat of the gods, by the way. We're talking about the stuff that you get in your email all the time. That kind of spam. You know what I'm talking about. Yeah, anyway. Thank you very much, Neil, for doing the guest slate on this program. Much appreciated. A program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A man called police after his wife, brandishing a handgun, stopped him from playing in the park with his buddies. George Postel of Florida said he was playing dominoes with his friends at the park in High Springs. Now, his wife approached the group of players and told them to get up and leave. The group of players complied with the irritated woman's demands. George got up as well, and he began walking away from his wife together with his friends. 44-year-old Twyla Postel was not happy with her husband's actions, and according to witnesses, she pulled out a gun and shot in his direction. Thankfully, she did not aim well and missed her husband. Police were called, and Twyla was arrested. Twyla denied the claim that she had fired a shot. She said that the sound came from kids' fireworks. So apparently, in that park, kids are allowed to be out to play, but her husband is not. Now, when police did not believe her over eyewitnesses, Twyla said that she was on probation for battery and that she wouldn't do anything to mess that up. Twyla was booked on a charge of domestic violence and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon without intent to kill. So, we're guessing probation for her is pretty much over. You know, it's amazing what people will brandish a gun over. Case in point, a wedding in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, ended on a sour note when someone allegedly pointed a gun at the groom. That person would be the bride. According to Police Sergeant Kyle Evans, the just-wedded 25-year-old Kate Elizabeth Pritchard pulled out of her wedding dress a 9mm pistol, pointed it at her new husband's head, and pulled the trigger. It didn't go off. She apparently didn't have a round in the chamber. She yanked the slide and was then able to shoot. She fired into the air, causing the wedding guests to run, according to Evans. Now, Pritchard, still in her wedding gown, was arrested in their honeymoon suite at the Clarion Inn, where officers said they found the couple arguing. She was taken to jail. Okay, this has to be true love. I mean, the guests all ran, but the groom didn't. What the heck would make him go on his honeymoon after his bride tried to blow his brains out at the altar? I'm no marriage counselor, but this relationship is doomed. Mark my words, doomed. And oh, we're not done with firearms. Shoppers at a Novi, Michigan Walmart say a woman pulled a loaded gun during a fight over a notebook. Novi police say two women, aged 32 and 46, were inside the store shopping for school supplies when they got into an altercation with two other women, a 20-year-old and her 51-year-old mother, over a notebook. Both duos of women were not backing down, as police and witnesses described the two women pulling the younger woman's hair. That mother got shoved out of the way as the three continued to fight. That mother then pulled out a gun. No injuries were reported. All four women could face assault charges. It is unknown which of the women, by the way, if any, walked away with the notebook. The incident was caught on camera and, of course, posted on Facebook, because, you know, everything happens these days on Facebook, as is everything happens at Walmart. Now, if this mother is willing to pull a gun over buying school supplies, just imagine what she might do if her kid gets bad grades. Yikes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first segment here with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an Australian man celebrated his 30th birthday by skydiving naked while playing a violin to promote male body image. Musician Glenn Donnelly leapt from a plane over New South Wales in hopes of raising a total of $15,000 for a trio of charities related to mental health and body image. "I'm being a real man by sharing the struggles that have plagued my life for 10 years," Donnelly wrote on a GoFundMe page that he started. Donnelly completed the tandem jump wearing nothing but a harness as he played Happy Birthday for himself on the violin. Donnelly compared his nerves prior to the nude skydiving stunt to the anxiety he felt dealing with his body dysmorphic disorder. In the 2 days following Donnelly's jump, he was able to raise nearly $3,500 of his $15,000 goal. Now, I've posted the video of the jump on the Stuff File Facebook page so you can see it in all its glory. So I've seen his body. He's just an average-looking guy, average build, average height, so I fail to see what his body image struggles could be unless he had fun house mirrors at his home. I did mention that it was a tandem jump, which of course means that a certified skydiver was strapped to a naked guy. Just have that visual in your head for a moment. And you know, whenever you hear about naked skydiving, it's always some guy. Women don't do such silly escapades. If they did, you would have a lot of folks on the ground asking, "Where's that whistling sound coming from?" Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first segment, shall we? Those of us who grew up in the 70s would be familiar with the name Oscar Goldman. That's the character Richard Anderson played on two shows, The $6 Million Man and The Bionic Woman. Richard Anderson, who had an amazingly long career as a supporting actor in film and TV, died on August 31st in his Beverly Hills home. He was 91. Way back in 1994, I was lucky enough to have a chance to talk to Richard. At the time, he was not only starring in a series of revival made-for-TV movies about the famed bionic characters, He was also an executive producer of said films. It was a chance to talk about the character that made him famous and also delve into his career. Here is part of that interview now. A lot of people, as I mentioned earlier, know you from the role of Oscar Goldman in The $6 Million Man. That show was on for quite a few years in the 70s, along with The Bionic Woman. I understand in this particular installment of the show, you have more of a role than just actor. Is that correct?
That's correct, exactly. The idea of bringing the show back in 1988 as a two-hour movie was mine, and I took it to the NBC network at that time, and they bought it, and the studio owned it, and they agreed. So we did the first return of The $6 Million Man, Bionic Woman, and out of 90 shows, it was number four, so that told us all something. And then we did the second one in 1980, and it fared equally as well. And then CBS decided they wanted to do this last January after I talked to them. So as a result, the studio decided by now I should be an executive producer. I did produce the last one as well in 1988. So I'm wearing that title as well, and I find it stimulating because I can have a little more input and also find out more of what Lee Majors and Lindsay Wagner wants to do. And being an actor, I understand where they're coming from.
It doesn't make it any more difficult for you as an actor to put on more than one hat in the same production?
Easier in the sense that the more an actor or anyone in the business can know about the other side, the better. It makes it simpler and easier. And of course, you also learn to appreciate, and this isn't necessarily for audiences that even care about, because they don't have to care. They're interested in what they see. But the preparation of a motion picture is something that's quite a job. There's pre-production, there's production, and what we're doing now, which is post-production. We're getting the music this afternoon. We're going to hear it. We've been editing it for a month. We are now going to dub it next week, and for those that are not familiar with that, we're putting all the effects, all the music, all the voiceovers, all the sounds from the different places we've been. It's put in the final editing, and that's called dubbing, and then we deliver it to the network next week or the week after next.
You've played Oscar Goldman for quite some time. Obviously, you're quite attached to the character. Did you think you'd be playing Oscar still when you first took that role in 1974?
Well, I liked that. It had a nice ring to it when my representative called and says, "How would you like to be in the $6 Million Man?" I said, "That has a nice sound to it." I somehow got a voice inside that said, "I think we're on to something."
We have since heard a lot about bionics in the medical field, but when you first got the script, did it seem a bit far-fetched back then?
You know, not to me. I'm an optimist, so when they talked about cybernetics, bionics, replacing maybe an arm that had been severed at the elbow and that they can replace it and have it work like a reg fingers and everything work through the nerve endings, it made sense to me. And of course, we've been on the show 3 years, and a man in Boston had that problem, and exactly the same thing happened to him, and it worked. And of course, today it's just, you know, it's routine.
Over the years in your career, you're probably one of the busiest actors in Hollywood. For people like me who have been couch potatoes, who watched everything growing up on TV, you're one of the people who we've seen a lot of. You had a variety of roles in various television shows, both as series regular or as guest star. What do you think you owe your good fortune to in all these years when let's face it, and especially in the Hollywood community, a lot of people aren't doing as well as you have on an ongoing basis?
First of all, I'm grateful. And secondly, I try to make myself castable in the sense to be versatile. And of course, the film, I started out actually at, if you look at my works, I started out in live television. And from there went into motion pictures. I was at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer for 6 years and did 30 movies there and got started in my career there. And then went to Fox and was under contract there, and then Universal, and did six television series and numerous pictures and miniseries and, as you say, guest appearances. But the thing I felt was the important thing is to be useful. And in any business, durability is a big factor. So I made myself available and I did my homework.
Going from live television and in series television and into the movies, a lot of people who make that jump to the movies like to stay in the movies and don't return to television, yet you did. Was anybody trying to coax you out of that move when you went back to TV?
Well, frankly, when I went into television, that's where the audience was, and in my opinion, still is.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see now. There are people that have been very successful from motion pictures into, I'm sorry, from television into motion pictures, and some have not. It depends on a lot of factors.
A lot of the characters you've played, I guess before Oscar Goldman, you either play authoritative police figures of some kind, or
right.
or villains.
I'm well, they saw an awful lot of me as an authority in the sense that in the Perry Mason series, the last year of its original, I played the Lieutenant Detective Steve Drum, the police element. In Dan August, I played the boss, the head of the police department. In the $6 Million Man, I'm the Washington Man, the Bionic Woman, the Washington Man. In Cover Up, I was the ambassador, and then there were several other series. In Bus Stop, I played a district attorney. So I guess you might say people see me in that direction. But I also wanted to show some versatility and asked for to play parts that weren't quite so straight on and. The good guy. I thought it might be interesting to play those other parts. So when I started doing one or two, I got a string of villains. Which, listen, it's those are fun to play too.
Do you ever concern yourself with being typecast?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with being typecast if you're typecast in the right thing. And I'm very grateful to Oscar Goldman. he's been very good to me. And we have plans beyond the show in terms of more. It's a show that doesn't go away, Peter. It's a show that seems to have durability. We look at Star Trek, and we say, what's happened there? Well, not only are they doing a new series on syndication, but they've done 6 motion pictures, and we have plans to make a motion picture of this as well.
So we
with
could
originals and, other people starting out in Bionics, so. And then maybe another syndicated series where some of us will appear occasionally. So it's a... and when we announced this show, Bionic Evermore, why, the reaction was just phenomenal. People grew up, as you say, with the show, and they have fond memories of it and want to see more of them. So that's really kind of what prompted me to say, let's bring this show to the forefront, because it's... In my opinion, this is what the public want. They want a family show. They want a show that has adventure and action, but also has a medical message.
You mentioned the possibility of syndication down the road and also a major motion picture, but you didn't mention the possibility of a network series. Is that out of the question? Will we not?
Not at all. Not at all. I just I don't want to, to promulgate too much about this. I believe in doing it and then talking about it. But since you seem to be so interested in Bionics and the principles in it, I wanted you to know that we have lots of plans for Bionics in the decades to come.
Even though you're wrapped up to a certain degree with this particular project, you still do other things. I understand you're also working on a motion picture recently.
Yes, it's called The Glass Shield. And it's a thriller, and was very well received at the Cannes Film Festival Award in 1994, in June. And it's directed by a very talented man, Charles Barnett, who now will be working on another film that he's invited me to join. It's a major role I'm playing, and it will be released in looks like February by Miramax Disney. So we're very flattered to have a distributor of the caliber of Miramax, as you know, did The Piano and is now showing Pulp Fiction, and they're a daring group and have been very, very successful.
You seem to have no problem going from the small screen to the big screen. A lot of people do.
I wonder why.
Yeah.
Why would you say, Peter?
What, your success from going from one small screen to the big screen?
Yeah.
I would say the fact that you're a character actor has a lot to do with it, and that they have an easier transition than leads do, for instance.
Hmm.
Is that a possibility?
That's a good answer, yeah. Well, we're going to see. We're going to find out here soon about one person that's decided to go from from television into a big picture.
Oh, David Caruso?
Don't you think?
Yep, that'll be interesting. It's ironic that he's being replaced on a television show by someone who made the same move several years ago, Jimmy Smits.
Right.
So it's interesting to see that transition.
Well, the world is about three blocks square, I always say.
With the diversity of roles you've had over the years, is there something that you haven't done yet that you've been wanting to do?
People always ask me what my favorite part is, and I say I haven't played it yet.
So you're still looking for that classic part?
Not really looking. I think if you don't look, it happens better. You know, don't get in the way of it, you know. Just a philosophy of mine. I find that there are a lot of things going on that you don't have anything to do with, higher powers and all that. So I don't think about that very much, but when something comes along that's really fun, I'm glad to do it, and it's whistling to work.
I mentioned earlier that you know, you're a great character actor, and you've been nominated for an Emmy as a supporting actor, and that seems to be what you've done very well for years and years and years.
It's true, and, you know, Tommy Lee Jones has proved he can do everything.
Mm-hmm.
Character work, leading work, and it all depends on a great... I'm sure audiences have heard this 1,000 times, that, you know, it, timing and whatever you might call it, providence, luck, or blessings, or whatever, you just... the whole thing's an adventure, Peter.
Did you ever at one point say, you know, I want to be the leading man? Was that a goal of yours?
I don't think about that. I happened to grew up in movies, and I kind of took an analysis of leading men in motion pictures as a boy and looked back upon them. And at Metro, I worked with them all, the big ones, Gable, Tracy, and in various films. And I found out they were all character men. Trained on the stage, played a lot of character roles. And they play a certain part, and then the studios in those days used to write the scripts for those people and made them into what we call first parts, leading men. They don't do that anymore. A great many people play, look at Bruce Willis, he plays characters in motion pictures as well as leading parts. No, I can't say that I ever differentiated between the two because it never occurred to me, you know, you just play the part you play, and sometimes I see it and say, let's do a series out of it, and that has happened to me on several occasions.
You mentioned there's some things they don't do anymore in Hollywood. One of the things they don't do anymore is they don't have the studio system, which you were part of when you first started. I understand that you kind of bucked the studio system at one time.
Well, there was a chance to, and that proves my point exactly, there was a chance to do a picture that I wanted to do in Germany, an American company. It was called Paths of Glory, and it was directed by a young man called Stanley Kubrick at that time, and it was a picture that has turned into a classic and has played in all the universities and certainly television and revived in theaters. I think it's been playing in Paris for 20 years, you know. It turned out to be one of the great anti-war stories, and I had a major role in that, and that really kicked me into a lot of parts after that. So that was a successful picture on the inside. The town loved it, and I think I had new respect for my work because it was much more serious as a film than the kind of pictures they were making at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer during the heyday of the stars.
Was being an actor something you always wanted to do?
I guess so, yeah. As a boy, my mother used to allow my brother and I go to movies at a very young age, and I was very impressed by it. And felt it was something I needed to do. I guess actors become actors for very special reasons. But it's what I do. It's my profession, and I think acting is a honorable profession, as Gregory Peck has said many times. And my sense is it's not everything. There are other things you do in life. I'm interested in travel and hit the tennis ball a bit, and I'm interested in people, and I read voraciously. I'm a history buff, and I've met an awful lot of interesting people in this world through the film medium, and it's led me in other directions as well, which have been equally satisfying. Balance is the key.
That was a conversation with actor Richard Anderson from October 31st, 1994. Richard passed away on Thursday, August 31st of this year at his home in Beverly Hills. He was 91 years old. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to author Raymond Benson. Plus, we'll hear from Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, who will share a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and lots more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, getting back to the stuff, Frances Knobel was visiting Suffolk, England from the United States when she saw a disturbing road sign. "I had to stop the car and go back to see if I had read the sign correctly," she said. "It didn't make any sense and seemed very gruesome that people would boast that poor domestic animals were being so horribly mistreated." The sign read, "Cat's eyes removed." Now, I live in Canada, so that term wouldn't have raised any eyebrows for me. What was removed from the road wasn't actual feline optics, but the reflective bumps in the middle of the road, variously known in the United States as bot dots or turtles or buttons. So many tourists had been disturbed by the signs, and Suffolk County Council decided to replace them. The signs will now refer to road studs. So I'll guess now that tourists will be upset that they missed the Chippendales. I don't understand, actually, why is a country changing signs to appease the sensibility of tourists who don't understand the language? I don't get it. You know, in this day and age, my feeling would be, if you're confused about something, Google it. Seriously. And move on. Anyway, rapper Jovan Virginie Scott, who uses the stage name Joey Badass, and the two S's are dollar signs, bragged on social media that he didn't need protective glasses to watch the recent eclipse. You know where this story is going already, don't you? Yeah. The 22-year-old New Yorker tweeted, "This ain't the first solar eclipse, and I'm pretty sure our ancestors ain't have no fancy eyewear. Also, pretty sure they ain't all go blind." And I'm pretty sure our ancestors had better grammar, but anyway. 2 hours later, he followed up, "Due to unforeseen circumstances, my Cleveland, Chicago, and Toronto shows on the hashtag Everybody Tour are canceled due to double vision." Suggested change to his stage name from Joey Badass to perhaps Joey Dumbass. Again, with dollar signs, if you would like. This is just a case of natural selection, isn't it? Yeah, I was thinking of making him the idiot of the day, but frankly, he just seems even too stupid for that. Really. And still with the eclipse, a California man with European heritage strong and pure placed an ad on Craigslist in advance of the solar eclipse on August 21st, seeking a worthy female to have sex with him in Oregon and to conceive a child that will be on the next level of human evolution. "Everything will be aligned in the local universe. Both of our cosmic orgasmic energy will be aligned with the planets," the ad stated. He had only one specific caveat: "You must like cats." Yeah, the ad has since been deleted. Well, you already know how I feel about cats, so this guy isn't getting high marks to start with. But seriously, did he think someone was going to respond to the ad? Or, since it was taken down, maybe somebody did? I don't know. Let's check back in about 9 months, shall we? Moving right along, Michael DeLome couldn't abide a Delray Beach, Florida McDonald's having run out of ice cream on August the 15th, so while he and his friend, 19-year-old Jerry Henry, waited in the drive-through line, DeLome asked Henry to get the stick out of the trunk. A McDonald's employee watched on surveillance video as Henry went to the trunk and removed a replica AR-15 airsoft rifle, then got back in the car. The workers couldn't tell that the weapon was not authentic and called 911, and Henry was charged with improper exhibition of a firearm. I scream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream, and if there isn't any, well, break out the weapons. Wow. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, in Florida, Pinellas Suncoast Transit Authority CEO Brad Miller and board chair Darden Rice helped Barbara Rigel celebrate her 103rd birthday on August 15th by presenting her with a lifetime bus pass. Rigel rides the bus to church about four times a week and said the pass will help with the costs. "Look at how much I can save," she said. You know, giving anyone who was 103 years old a lifetime supply of anything isn't really doing much. That's just an empty gift. I mean, unless she's extremely optimistic, at 103, she's probably not even buying green bananas anymore. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Every time we talk to writer Raymond Benson, we start off by saying he's very busy. It seems every time we turn around, he has another book coming out. His latest novel is The Secrets on Chicory Lane, which is coming out in October, but is available for pre-order now on Amazon.com. What's his latest novel about? Well, Raymond joins us via Skype from Illinois to tell us all about it. Hi, Raymond.
Hey, Peter. Good to be on your show again.
Great to have you on the program again. We've talked several times. For those who don't know, you've also written several James Bond books. You were commissioned by the estate of Ian Fleming to write several books. So in addition to writing your own stuff, you've been writing James Bond stuff as well. Before we get to talking about The Secrets of Chicory Lane, I want to ask you, what's the difference for you structure-wise or in just your writing style when you're writing something that is purely from your own brain where there are no limitations because it's your creation, as opposed to writing something that fits within a genre and is part of someone else's canon?
Right. Well, first of all, you know, the whole James Bond thing, if you can believe it, that started 20 years ago. That was 20 years ago when I did Bond. It was in the late 90s, early 2000s. And so the last Bond book I did was 2002, and that's 15 years ago.
So, wow.
You know, I've done a lot of stuff since then. I've done a lot of my own, you know, I kind of left that behind and started really concentrating on my own original suspense novels. I still have done other tie-in books, you know, novelizations and stuff, but that's good, you know, bread and butter money. But my heart is in writing my own original books, and I've done, you know, quite a few of them in the last 15 years. Most recently, of course, the Black Stiletto 5-book serial. But I now have a new publisher, and The Secrets on Chicory Lane is a standalone mystery. It's in many ways, it's really a novel. It's a, and I hope I can say that I think it's my first real literary mystery, literary fiction. I've really tried really hard to make it more of that type of a novel. It's a memory story. It deals with a lot of social issues like mental illness and capital punishment. You know, I hope it strikes a chord. I'm getting some good notices from at least from author blurbs. We're still waiting for the professional reviews to come out, but it's very exciting. And you know, Skyhorse, I'm working with a great editor named Herman Graff, who was one half of the great publisher Carroll and Graff, and he has his own imprint at Skyhorse, and I'm privileged and honored to be in his stable of authors.
Well, tell us a little bit about what The Secrets of Chicory Lane is about.
Okay. There's a woman. I've been writing female protagonists a lot lately. In fact, this is my 11th book with a female protagonist. I joke that I used up all my testosterone on James Bond, and now I write women. But anyway, she is a romance writer, a very successful romance writer living in Chicago, and she receives a letter from an attorney in Texas who tells her that her best friend, childhood friend, Eddie, is about to be executed. He's on death row, and his last request was to see her. So she gets on a plane and travels to Texas, and along the way, we get sequences of her memories throughout the decades. First, the 1960s, when they were children, living in a small town in Texas, and then the 70s, and then the 80s, and then the 90s. As they grew up and how their relationship changed over the decades. And the book culminates in her visit with Eddie at death row in the prison, and that's when he reveals the big secret. So hopefully, there's a twist ending there, and there's a lot of revelations going on.
How do you come up with the genesis of a story like this? What part of your brain creates the novel, like The Secrets on Chicory Lane?
Well, you know, authors really hate that question. where do ideas come from? Because most of the time, we really don't know. I grew up in a small town in Texas, and I have set several of my books in this same town. It's a fictional town right now. It's called Lamete, Texas, but it's really based on my hometown of Odessa, Texas. And I think, you know, people from my town will recognize it when they read the book. But I fictionalize it. And, you know, I lived on a street much like Chicory Lane in the book when I was a kid. And there were secrets. There were some interesting things going on in the 60s. So part of it is autobiographical. Part of it is a result of my fevered imagination. And I had something to say about capital punishment and child abuse and mental illness. They were issues that were important to me. And so I fashioned a story about it.
You say that people who live where you grew up would recognize the area. Would anybody who knows you recognize any of the characters?
Absolutely not. They're all fictional. I mean, the main protagonist, you know, might be really me, except the protagonist is female. So a lot of my own thoughts and ideas and world outlook, you know, I put into her head.
People grow as human beings. They grow as writers. As we mentioned, you wrote Bond books in the past, so you wrote for somebody else as well. Has the writing of Bond books changed in any way the way you write your own stuff?
Well, I think I've evolved since then. I think I've become a better writer, for sure. But the process of writing has not changed. They say there's two types of writers. Those who are plotters, that is, writers who outline and plan their book before they start writing, and pantsers, who are seat of the pantsers, who just sit down and start writing and let the writing take them wherever it takes them. There's pros and cons, I think, for both styles. There's plenty of writers I know who are pantsers and they do a great job, and there's plenty of writers I know who are plotters who do a great job. I am of the former. I am a plotter. I like to outline. I was required to do that when I did Bond, and so that kind of taught me what a good thing that was to outline and plan ahead. And that's what I do still with my own original novels. I do an outline first and do a lot of research. I like to travel to my locations and get things right. And Yeah, that's, you know, the process has not changed. I just, you know, I think I've just gotten better at the craft as the years have gone by.
So since you're a plotter, are there any surprises for you as you're sitting in front of your computer, or do you know exactly where the story is going from the time you first start sitting down to type?
Well, there are still surprises. I you know, I'm not married to the outline. It's more of a guide. It's more of a map. Just like when you're on a road trip, you have a map of where you're going, but you might see some side things as you go through a town. You might want to stop and go, oh, I'd like to check that museum out, or I'd like to see that big ball of string museum that's on the side of the road, or you know, or that fudge factory that you pass and go, oh, I think I want to try that. So it's the same thing with writing. A character might surprise you with some of the dialogue, and then you'll explore a little avenue or something. But I don't think my overall goal of where I know the story is going to go, I don't think that ever changes, because I decide that up front. It's part of the process for me. I like to know where I'm going. I like to know where the characters are going. I like to know how it's going to end before I start.
I said in the introduction that you're basically very busy. You're a very prolific writer. I got in contact with you this time around, because we've spoken in the past before, but I got in contact with you because I got an email for a title, and I said, oh, let's talk about your new book coming out. And you said, oh, wait a minute, that book that you're talking about doesn't come out until May of 2018.
That's right. Yeah, I have another book with Skyhorse that's coming out in May 2018. It's called In the Hush of the Night. And that's a very different type of thriller. It's a more traditional thriller. It's an FBI story with a female protagonist, again. It takes place in Chicago, and it's about human trafficking. So it's another social issue that I was concerned about and wanted to write about. And I did spend a day with the Chicago FBI field office, female head of the human trafficking division. So hopefully it's a gritty, realistic look at how that works.
Wow.
And I'm currently writing the next book, which is hopefully, you know, it'll be published the following year. So I'm currently working on that. I just was in L.A. last week researching that. So
do you work on one book from beginning to end, or do you have several projects working at the same time? Are you like the plate spinners on the old Ed Sullivan show?
I really prefer to work on one thing at a time, but in the past there have been times when I've had to do two things at once, when I've like been working on one of my own things and then suddenly I get a tie-in job, a work for hire job. So I will work on both at the same time. Lately, the last couple of years, I've just been concentrating on my own work, and I do one thing at a time. But you got to remember, while I'm working on a current project, the one I just finished is going through the editing stage at the publisher. So I'm going to be copy editing with my editor in October in The Hush of the Night. So I'll be, you know, working on my current project while editing, you know, doing the editing for the next book.
Like I said, a very, very busy man. The current book, the one that is now available for pre-order, is called The Secrets on Chicory Lane. It comes out in October. Raymond, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being on with us once again.
Thank you for having me, Peter. It's always great to talk to you.
Raymond Benson, author of The Secrets on Chicory Lane. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check the show number for this program, which is show number 0420, and you'll find links to Raymond's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Each year around Labor Day, tens of thousands of people gather in the Nevada desert for an unusual event called the Burning Man Festival. According to its website, the week-long affair is dedicated to community, art, self-expression, and self-reliance. True to its name, the event culminates with the burning of a large structure that looks like a man. When the Burning Man tumbles over, participants are allowed to throw mementos and other objects into the fire. In order to participate, everyone agrees to assume all risk of property loss and personal injury. Well, a few years ago, a man tripped after tossing something into the fire and badly burned his hands. As you might guess, he filed a lawsuit claiming the organizers of the event were negligent. Let's be fair, these lawsuits often end badly for event organizers, but this time the court actually dismissed the lawsuit. and on appeal, higher courts agreed, ruling that by walking near the fire, the man assumed the risk of tripping, a lesson in personal responsibility that allowed the event to continue for others to experience. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do indeed have Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, from the city that never sleeps, New York. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the very dry streets of New York City where it isn't raining yet.
I take it you're expecting some precipitation, are you?
Yeah, well, because the weatherman and the weather bureau have to keep themselves busy by keep telling us that there's going to be a disaster, there's going to be a disaster. In the case of Texas, they happen to be right, which surprised me because I figured if the Weather Bureau says there's going to be a hurricane, it usually turns out there isn't. But in this case, they were terribly, terribly right.
Now, we have talked over the years about your life behind the wheel as a taxi driver, but we've never talked about what happens when the call of nature comes your way.
Well, that is a problem, and that's mainly why we don't have too many lady taxi drivers. We have male taxi drivers, and the reason for that is there really is no provision for that in New York City. A taxi driver, male type, forget about the women for the minute, has a real problem. What's he going to do? There's no place to park. There's no place to stop. There's no such thing as public bathrooms or anything like that. What they do, and I'll try to tell the story kind of delicately, is the average New York City cab driver will start off his shift with a cup of coffee, let's say. Well, once he finishes the cup of coffee, he keeps the cup, if you catch my drift.
Ooh, yeah, got your drift.
So the city's not talking about trying to do something. I don't know what they're going to do, but it is a problem. I will point out to you that I've done the cup thing on a side street by myself. I've even done it when the cab is moving by myself. I've yet to do it while the cab is moving with somebody in the cab. That'll be the next plateau I have to reach.
Yikes. Well,
not letting them know what I'm doing, of course.
Of course. I'm just curious to know, though. I mean, there are not a lot of public restrooms in New York City, as you've just described. But what about all those fast food restaurants, your Starbucks, your McDonald's? Couldn't you just zip into one of those places, or is that not possible?
No, you can't zip into them because they won't make you, they'll make you buy something. Also, where are you going to park? Worst is Dunkin' Donuts. Dunkin' Donuts will look you straight in the face and say, oh, I hope they're not one of your sponsors. We'll say, yeah, we don't have a bathroom. And if you want to play around with them, you can say, yeah, so where does the help go? No, even if they would let you in, which they won't let you in, as I say, there's no place to put your vehicle. No, you got to walk around with a paper cup.
Wow, the call of nature really is a problem in the tri-state area. Meanwhile, I understand that the Secret Service have a potty problem of their own.
Yeah, well, they're not really associated, but the Secret Service is a bunch of obnoxious twerps who show up in New York City with little hearing aids in their ears. They're really nasty guys, and women for that matter. Move it along! You know, they're really not nice. Yeah, we know they're watching out for the president, but you could be a little bit politer. Anyway, it turns out that they're going to be broke, their budget for these jaunts that they go on with the president, because they spend money for outlandish things. It seemed that at some particular function, they got some porta potties, and they were paying $7,000 for each rental of the porta potty. That's a lot of money. And the only way I can describe it is the Secret Service is obviously pissing away the citizens' taxpayers' money.
Well, maybe they have the same gold fixtures that are in Trump Tower.
Yeah, well, that's possible, too. You know, it's possible.
Meanwhile, getting back to restaurants, which I mentioned a little earlier, I understand there's a rule requiring restaurants, convenience stores, and other establishments to post calorie counts on prepared food. How's that going?
It's going terrible because the food industry is doing everything it can to stop it from being passed. all the city wants to do is just say that if you sit down in a restaurant and you're going to get a plate of mashed potatoes, how many calories is in it? That's not a big deal, and that's a very healthy, health-wise thing to do. But, of course, the food industry, being a bunch of creeps, is just fighting against it, and they're going to do everything to stop it. It's not clear in my mind why they're going to stop it. I don't see how it affects them in their pocket. And I think a person should know what the calories are. In this day and age where everybody has diabetes or heart condition, you know, because everybody used to die when they're 30. Now everybody dies when they're much older. It's important to know what you're eating. So I think they're a bunch of jerks, but the city will probably win out in the end.
Meanwhile, I think back to a story from many, many years ago. Leona Hemsley. You remember her? Of course you remember her.
She was my landlady.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah. I think back to all the tabloid stories about how much money she left her pets. Meanwhile, we have a story today from your website at Gabby.com, which deals with a deadbeat dad involving pets. This is a strange one.
Yeah, well, he's paying the child support or whatever he's paying support to his wife. But he refuses to give her money for the dog. And the tab has run up to about $36,000. I don't know what she's spending the money on. And she's taking him to court, and she's telling the court that the dog should be maintained. I don't think the dog should be maintained in the first place. And at that rate, which is thoroughly ridiculous. But that means, ladies and gentlemen, certainly the gentleman, if you're going to marry a woman, don't marry one with a dog. And once you are married to a woman without a dog, don't buy her a dog, because once you get divorced, that dog is going to be a pain in the you-know-what.
Wow. Okay. And still with animals, I understand there have been ducks on the subway?
Yeah. It happened a couple of days ago. Some person was walking in the subway car and had a duck on a leash. And, of course, the people that were in the car thought at first it was a dog, which you can't do unless it's a seeing eye dog. But then it turned out to be a duck, quack, quack. So now everybody's talking about it. But, of course, what we've discovered, it's actually against the law to have a duck in New York City at all. It's considered like a farm animal. You know, you can't have a cow, you can't have a sheep. So there is one person we know of now who's walking around with a duck on a leash, quack, quack.
Another quack on the New York subway. Wow. Meanwhile, there was a driver, I understand, of a garbage truck who trashed some vehicles.
Yeah, I put a beautiful picture on the website of some of the damage that he did. He just was nipping the sauce too much. And a garbage truck, as you know, is a pretty big thing. And he did quite a bit of damage. It was just an excuse for me to show the picture, because I kind of enjoyed the picture. Mm. Nobody got hurt.
Nobody got hurt. Well, that's good. That's good. Well, maybe he was just another driver looking for a restroom.
That's possible. That's possible.
And I know you've had, you always have, I know you had a celebrity sighting. This one's pretty impressive. One of many several past Mrs. Trumps.
Oh, thank God you didn't do a gentle segue and you gave me a hint as to what I had said to you. Yes, it was Marla Maples. You never really hear much about her. Good-looking babe. They got married, they got divorced, and she was gone. But for a while, she lived in the apartment house that we used to live in, which was run by Harry Helmsley and Mrs. Helmsley. See, that's like that. What's that game you play, Three Shades of Next to somebody?
3 degrees of separation?
Yeah,
yeah. I mean,
that's what that is. So there's my connection to Leona Helmsley and Donald Trump and Marla Maples.
Now, where did you see Marla?
She was just strolling along, having a good time and playing, I think it was baseball or softball. I don't remember exactly.
Oh, so you didn't see her with her daughter, Tiffany?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Because we don't hear from Tiffany much.
Do we know there really is a Tiffany?
Oh, there is a Tiffany. There's definitely a Tiffany. But, we, you know, that's the forgotten Trump child. We don't hear a lot about
Tiffany.
Yeah,
and it's the forgotten Trump wife, too, if you think about it.
Well, that's true. That is true indeed. Well, sir, It is always a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you, and I don't want to keep you too long because I don't know if nature is going to be calling you. So I thank you for being on the program with us once again. People can always go to your website at www.gabby.com. They can send you an email to peter@gabby.com. Thanks for being on the program once again, sir.
And thank you. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And yes, boys and girls, we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have time for one more item, and it's the one you've all been waiting for. You know what that is, boys and girls. Yes, it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Surveillance video from a July 27th break-in at the home of 59-year-old John C. Burbage of Naples, Florida, showed a surprisingly familiar picture of the perpetrators. 22-year-old Harold Russell Lanham and his dad, 41-year-old James Edward Lanham, both of whom Burbage employed and both of whom were wearing their work uniforms. The Lanham duo stole a safe containing more than $30,000 worth of cash and property from their boss's home. Now, why, oh why, would you think that if you robbed your boss's house, there wouldn't be surveillance of the property? And for the love of God, why would you wear your uniforms to his house to commit the crime? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0420. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links to all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0420. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were listening to this at the same time as watching The Wizard of Oz and listening to Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, well, it's a waste of electricity. There are some things you just can't multitask.